Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young.
It was viewed as a shameful threat to the free market. It was viewed as un-American, kind of a charitable handout to folks that needed to be pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps.
Today's show features an interview with Angela Babb of Indiana University's Department of Geography. She's talking about the origins of the Farm Bill and how nutrition assistance programs like SNAP, or food stamps, got lumped in with agriculture policy. Harvest Public Media has a story on the possible comeback of hemp as Congress considers legalization of the crop nationally. Chef Daniel Orr has a recipe for Welsh cakes to share with us, and we've got new theme music by Aaron Toby. So stay with us. But first, let's go to Alex Chambers for the news.
Thanks, Kate. Good to be here. Environmentalists have been concerned about cattle farming for a long time. In 2015, the United Nations launched a project to find more sustainable practices for raising beef in four European countries. Conventional livestock production contributes about 14.5% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, and beef alone accounts for over 40% of that amount. That's because cattle churn out methane, a powerful greenhouse gas, and overgrazing can release carbon from the soil. But a four-year study at Michigan State University suggests that carbon losses can be reduced by strategically moving cattle around sections of pasture in the last few months before slaughter. The researchers tested this method, called adaptive multi-paddock grazing, while adding manure to pastures and refraining from using pesticides or chemical fertilizers. The group measured the cattle's, let's call it methane output, and compared the overall carbon loss from the soil with conventional feedlot methods. They found a big drop in overall greenhouse gas emissions with this type of grazing compared to feedlot finishing because the soil absorbed carbon that canceled out the methane. Soil captures more carbon when root systems are left intact, and manure that's left on the ground doesn't release as much nitrogen, another greenhouse gas. The method also reduces soil erosion from growing conventional cattle feed crops like corn and soy. The study is slated for publication in the May issue of the journal Agricultural Systems. In February, we reported on the increasing rates of farmer suicides and the unanimous passage of a bill in the Washington State Legislature establishing a free behavioral health support and suicide prevention program for employees of the agriculture industry. Since the passage of HB 2671, there has been movement on the national front to support farmer mental health. Minnesota Congressman Tom Emmer introduced the Stemming the Tide of Rural Economic Stress and Suicide, or STRESS, Act last month, which puts federal dollars toward building and strengthening a national network for farmer support services. In a time when farmers are killing themselves at twice the rate of veterans, legislation supporting farmer mental health is vital and necessary. But a Civil Eats article published this week asks, is it enough? The article calls attention to the fact that farmer and ag worker mental health problems are the result of decades of policies that have favored consolidation and led to volatile markets, devastating price drops, and the hollowing out of rural communities. For example, the price of milk, which is set by the federal government, has dropped so low that dairy farmers are being paid less for their milk than it costs to produce it. It's no secret that financial hardship is a cornerstone of psychological distress. So the sentiment among some farmers is resentful that the focus is on counseling, when what they really need is cash to pay their current debts and policies to support their livelihoods in the long term. Brenda Cochran, head of Farm Women United, told Civil Eats that the STRESS Act was missing the point. Instead, she proposed setting a limit so that the price of milk can't drop below $20 per hundredweight. The federal government is forcing traditional farms out of business, and there's no safety net, Cochrane said. Why would you even need a safety net if the government wasn't throwing you off a cliff? And that's the news. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow for those stories.
After nearly 80 years of heavy federal restrictions, hemp could soon make a comeback. Colorado is the country's top producer after hemp was legalized there in 2013. And now Congress may legalize it nationally. As Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports, it's causing some mixed feelings in the hemp industry.
In northern Colorado, this year's NoCo Hemp Expo was the largest in its five-year history. 150 vendors spent 2 days promoting and selling all kinds of products, from plastics to food and soda.
We do a honeydew melon that's a melon guava mix, nice, light, and refreshing.
Scott Leshman is with Cannabinoid Creations. They infuse their beverage line with cannabidiol, or CBD. It's an oil extracted from hemp that's purported to have strong medicinal properties.
After spending a year and a half of my life in bed and two back surgeries, I'm very fortunate to be up and about and standing, and I'm not on all the Vicodin or all the opioids, and this saved my life.
CBD products are driving the budding hemp industry and could reach $1 billion in sales over the next 5 years. And that could be bolstered by the Hemp Farming Act of 2018, by Republican Senator Mitch McConnell.
First and foremost, this bill will finally legalize hemp as an agricultural commodity and remove it from the list of controlled substances.
Right now, over half of U.S. states, including Iowa, Nebraska, and McConnell's home state of Kentucky, have passed some form of legislation allowing for the cultivation of hemp, though many are research programs that limit production. Retailers like Leshman say the change would be welcome, but won't impact business.
Yeah, I mean, based on how we already do things, we have zero issue with how things are written at present, so it doesn't matter for us.
It's those who grow hemp who are paying close attention, like Ryan Laughlin. He's a fourth-generation farmer with 300 acres of hemp in Springfield, Colorado. He was a presenter on a panel at the expo.
Yeah, we just had a little, concerns with, what THC levels could be, and, so there's still a little bit up in the air there.
Hemp is a cousin of marijuana, so it does contain a small amount of the psychoactive component THC. Because of that, farmers can't grow plants containing more than 0.3% THC. If they go over, they're required by law to destroy the crop.
Plus, we have to pay quite a bit to have the test done every year. So it's money that comes already out of an empty pocket of most farmers.
Laughlin would like to see a threshold of at least 1%, and here's why. According to the Colorado Department of Agriculture, farmers have reported that extra sunlight and higher altitudes can cause hemp to produce extra THC. McConnell's bill isn't expected to change that limit, but no one knows for sure because the bill hasn't been introduced.
I personally wouldn't lose a lot of sleep over anything that's potentially happening in a bill, because I think we've all seen how little is happening in Congress, period.
Don Sinning is with the agency. He says the U.S. hemp industry is in its infancy, and he says new hemp varieties have been developed that cannot produce more than the current legal amount of THC.
It won't be an issue. Given enough time, allowing the industry to develop, it will not be an issue.
Zane Kuna grows hemp for Frida Farms on 2 acres in Fort Collins, Colorado. He had a booth at the expo.
Oh, man, there's tons of questions. Man, I got 5 acres. How can I grow hemp? Or what does CBD do? And
he says he's focusing more on the big picture. The most important thing for him is that Mitch McConnell's bill passes.
We hope it just goes through, so it's just a farm commodity, like corn and alfalfa. So instead of the cannabis industry.
Right now, Kunal can't even get a bank account for his farm. Legalization could open up access to things like federal loans and crop insurance. And hemp could once again be a major American crop. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
And thanks to our partners at Harvest Public Media. You can find more from them at harvestpublicmedia.org. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. Needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Griddle cakes, and basically any kind of breads that you can cook on the stove. It makes bread baking more accessible somehow. Something you could just whip up right before the meal without all that planning ahead that goes into yeast breads. Chef Daniel Orr has one of those for us this week.
But today we're going to make the Welsh cakes, and Welsh cakes are a lot like English muffins. They're a type of griddle cake, and what we do is we're going to make the dough. So we have 1 cup of plain flour. We have 3 ounces of granulated white sugar. And traditionally in England, they would use currants, but I'm going to use some dried cherries today. You could use dried cranberries, you could use currants, you could use raisins, whatever kind of dried fruit you like. I'm going to put in a half teaspoon of sweet seasoned spices, and that's one of my favorite spice blends. But if you don't have that, you could use pumpkin pie spice or Chinese five spice. Or just some plain cinnamon. I'm going to add some baking powder, a half teaspoon of that, and that's going to be our leavener. We're just going to stir that around a little bit with our hands, and then I'm going to add the butter, and we're going to add 6 tablespoons of butter. And we're just going to work that into the flour with our hands, and what you're looking for is kind of a cornmeal-like consistency. You don't want to overwork it. You want your butter to be nice and cold. It's kind of like making biscuits in a way. And you can see it's starting to turn kind of yellow. So we've really worked that into kind of a cornmeal-like consistency. We're going to add an egg to that and just a little splash of milk. And we're just going to work this into a dough now, just with your hands. Yeah, no reason to dirty the mixer. And then you want to have it to a consistency where you can roll it out, and we're about right there. So we're going to put some flour on our table. Remove the dough from the bowl and just kind of pat that out to even consistency. Now I've got my rolling pin. I'm just going to dust that with a little bit of flour so I can roll this out evenly. You can use a ring cutter or a jar, or I'm using a little measuring cup. Just going to cut little rounds.
Once you've cut out the rounds of dough, you'll cook them in a hot skillet with a little butter until they're golden on both sides. About 3 minutes per side.
You don't want your heat too high because then, of course, they'll burn before they're cooked. So this recipe makes 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. You got 10 good ones and one extra one for the cook.
And there you have it. Easy as pie. Actually, way easier than pie. Pie can be kind of tricky. You can find the recipe on our website, eartheats.org. Come follow me. Journey, on a journey, on a journey. Hello again, Alex.
Hey, Kate.
So we've been talking about the Farm Bill this year on Earth Eats. We've had some news stories and conversations with farmers, people concerned about SNAP.
Yeah, because the Farm Bill is up again this year, and there's a lot at stake.
Right. It makes a real difference for farmers and for emergency food providers and those relying on SNAP or other government food aid.
Yeah, definitely. I got curious about how it is that the Farm Bill deals with ag policy, but also with food stamps. I mean, how did that even happen?
I know. It's not obvious.
So I invited Angela Babb to the studio to help me understand some of the history of the Farm Bill and how it ends up including so many things that don't have anything to do with farming. Angela Babb's a visiting professor in the Department of Geography at Indiana University. She studies the Farm Bill and has a particular interest in the SNAP portion of the bill.
And SNAP stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It used to be called food stamps.
Yeah. So I started by asking Angela to explain the origins of the Farm Bill.
It started in the 1930s as a way to help farmers after the Dust Bowl in a very volatile market already, as agriculture is. After the Dust Bowl, farmers really needed some financial supports. President FDR signed the first Agricultural Adjustment Act in 1933, which basically put some production controls down to help regulate commodity prices and provided grain reserves for farmers to set aside product when there was too much on the market that was driving down prices. So the Agricultural Adjustment Act, now we consider it the Farm Bill, was put in place to help farmers, particularly after the Dust Bowl, secure their incomes, but it's changed very much.
Yeah, it has changed a lot since then. Now the Farm Bill directs about $95 billion in annual federal spending.
80% of that is for nutrition assistance programs, most of that being SNAP, formerly known as food stamps, and then the rest going into the Emergency Food Assistance Program, which is the funding for food banks.
So how did that happen?
Well, it's got a long, complicated history. So the first food stamp program was in 1939. It was just 3 years after the Farm Bill, the first Farm Bill. And this first food stamp plan looked very different than what we have now. It was a system in which you buy stamps and then receive extra stamps only for buying surplus commodities. So a person would go to a Department of Ag office, buy a dollar in orange stamps that can be used on anything, any kind of food, and then would receive 50 cents in blue stamps that have to be used on surplus commodities. Those at the time were butter, eggs, pork lard, dried beans, wheat flour, cornmeal, things like that.
What do you mean by surplus commodities?
So things that were being produced in such great degree that the price was being driven down by the great amount being on the market.
Okay. So that sounds like it was really helping the farmers out.
It really was. And actually, farmers were actually destroying their surpluses until the discourse around the program changed from one of hunger relief to one of surplus distribution. There was actually a lot of contestation around that first plan. It was viewed as a shameful threat to the free market. It was viewed as un-American, kind of a charitable handout to folks that needed to be pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps.
And this was in the 30s?
Yes.
Like the height of the Depression?
Yes,
the middle
in 1939. Yeah. It was controversial from the very beginning. Some of the Protestant ethic and kind of American ideologies around what people deserve and handouts versus gaming the system, that's been there from the very beginning. Even at a time when, like you said, like right after the Great Depression, there's still this stigma around poor households getting any assistance from the state. So legislators started framing it differently in order to have farmers be more receptive to the program. and to stop, you know, destroying their surplus instead of kind of funneling it into these networks for needy families. And unfortunately, that first program ended about 1943 because with the war, there weren't really enough farmers and enough surplus at that point. So the program ended and didn't start up again until the 60s.
And what brought the program back?
Well, there was still a need. Slowly, people were starting to realize that folks kind of at the margins were still experiencing hunger. And there was a call, especially from legislators representing urban areas, realizing that there was extreme poverty that needed to be addressed. So again, the issue was between representatives from urban versus representatives from rural areas. And the compromise came down to, you know, the rural communities being able to distribute their surplus and the urban communities being able to access food.
Okay, so that makes sense, but I'm curious about what the debate was that led to that compromise.
I know that one thing that was really important, and this was after the pilot program, it was 1969 when CBS put out a documentary. It was about an hour long. It was called Hunger in America, and they visited four different communities across the U.S. to show that poverty and hunger was prevalent among Native American communities, among Mexican American communities, the rural white populations on the East Coast, that poverty was hidden. And that CBS documentary really kind of pulled the wool off of people's eyes. And that's after that we see the food stamp program of 1977, which is the model that we have today. There's no purchase requirement. There's no restriction to surplus commodities. Basically, if you are within the poverty threshold, you are eligible for food stamps. In 1984, we saw the first electronic benefits transfer cards, the EBT cards that everyone uses today on food stamps. They've been used in all states now as of 2004. Oh, and I forgot to say that actually before 1977, the pilot programs of the 40s and the 60s weren't in all states. And they had very different rules from state to state on how many you had to buy. Sometimes you had to buy a whole month's supply of orange stamps to get the blue stamps. And that was keeping people from being able to afford them at all. And that's another thing exposed by the CBS documentary, that people couldn't afford the food stamp program in the first place. So they had to eliminate the purchase requirement.
So it was set up to help partly the farmers. Does it do that?
Originally, it did really help the small, medium-scale family farmers. And today, still, we see a lot of farmers dependent on the commodity programs out of the farm bill. But the greatest percentage of financial support out of the farm bill is going towards the large-scale commodity producers, those growing corn and soy, wheat and cotton, and now peanuts. And we see a lot less of that funding going towards the small-scale farmers, especially those in specialty crops.
Like vegetables?
Fruits and vegetables, legumes.
Wow. Why are those specialty crops?
You know, that's a great question. they should be mainstream.
Right.
Crops. I think a lot of it has to do with the nature of the crops themselves. So corn and soy were very easily mechanized and industrialized agriculturally. And there's also the political side of it, the support, the lobbying support that we see from big agribusiness that has a solid interest in subsidizing corn and effectively subsidizing meat and dairy production.
By way of the corn.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there's a trickle down in the sense that in calling the vegetables and fruits specialty crops, that makes them less available to people because they're more expensive. They're not subsidized as thoroughly, right?
Yeah, they just recently in the last farm bill became eligible for the crop insurance programs. So that was a major benefit to those specialty crop growers. But they still aren't receiving the subsidies, which are part of the commodity programs, which are separate from the crop insurance programs. So with the commodity programs, basically a farmer can say, I'm going to grow this many acres of corn, and they receive the money to grow that corn. They're guaranteed a certain price.
Okay, so I think I'm getting a better understanding about how this works, about how the Farm Bill ended up including the nutrition assistance program.
Yeah, and even how it is that corn, soybeans, and wheat became the largest commodity crops. I didn't realize the role that mechanization might have played.
Yeah, this discussion helps me understand how it got started, but I still don't get why it continues to be this way. Why are the food assistance programs still included in the Farm Bill?
Well, Angela Babb has a lot to say about that. She talks about the problems that come up due to the glaring conflict of interest.
Wait, what conflict of interest?
The fact that the USDA is responsible for marketing and distributing surplus commodities and also is the agency that sets nutrition guidelines for government food assistance programs.
Oh, good, good. I want to hear about that. But unfortunately, it's going to have to wait until next week. We've run out of time.
So it's a two-part series then?
Yep. And it just so happens that our partners at Harvest Public Media are also doing a multi-part series on SNAP. So we can start running that next week, too.
Oh, good. We're all going to be very current with our understanding of the Farm Bill and how the food stamp program ties in.
Just in time, too. The Farm Bill process is rolling along in Congress as we speak.
Okay. So tune in next week for the rest of our conversation with Angela Babb from IU's Department of Geography.
Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. Needmoreroasters.com. Hey, Alex.
Yeah, Kate?
One more thing. Are you excited about our new theme music?
I am super excited. It's great to have a new sound for the show.
I feel so lucky to have Erin Tobey making our new theme. She's a local artist, but she's world-renowned. And if you haven't listened to her 2016 release, Middle Maze, I highly suggest you do that right away.
Yes, do it. We'll link to it at eartheats.org.
A big thanks to everyone who makes Earth Eats possible. That includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Angela Babb. Earth Eats theme music is composed and performed by Erin Tobey, and our executive producer is John Bailey. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young. We'll see you next week.